Hello, I'm Richard Adie. This is Best Practice. This week, you'll meet the chief executive of the largest local government area in Australia. It's vast, bigger than Victoria, and Alan Cooper has been running it since 1998. Let's begin with something that's been in the news lately. Robots, artificial intelligence, automation, you've probably seen the headlines about humans being superseded in the workplace and the end of work. But Jeff Borland doesn't think so. The Professor of Economics at the University of Melbourne believes those predictions of doom and gloom are wrong.
Well, I guess we take several perspectives on it. First of all, just looking at the data, you can look at things in Australia like the total amount of hours worked per capita in Australia going back to the mid-1960s. And if you do that, it's pretty much a straight line. There's certainly no evidence that the amount of work available to the Australian population has decreased since the mid-1960s, and certainly no sign that it's decreased with the increased use of IT computer-type technology since the mid-1990s. The other data-based perspective you can take is to look at the amount of churning that's happening in the labour market. A claim that's also often made about new technologies is that they're causing a faster pace of change in the labour market. But if you look at indicators, for example, like job tenure, the amount of time people have been in their current jobs, there's no sign that the proportion of people who've been in jobs for short periods of time, less than a year, is increasing. In fact, what you do observe is that the proportion of people who've been in jobs for a long time, more than 10 years, has increased pretty consistently since the early 1980s, driven mainly by with females being increasingly engaged in the labour market, a much larger proportion of females being in their jobs for 10 years or more. So one way you can think about tales of the death of work is to look at the data, look at what's been happening in the Australian labour market since the larger scale adoption of IT, computer-based technology since the mid-1990s. And when you do that, there's no sign that the total amount of work is decreasing. There's no sign that the pace of change in the labour market is getting more rapid.
There must have been, though, productivity gains in specific sectors, which now need many fewer people to do actually more than they were doing before.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. So by saying that the total amount of work hasn't changed, of course, we're not arguing that new technologies don't have any effect on the labour market. Of course, new technologies, and it's been a consistent story since the Industrial Revolution, new technologies do destroy some types of jobs. But the other part of the story is that new technologies also create new jobs. They do that in a couple of ways. First of all, as you mentioned, new technologies increase our productivity. They enable us to produce the existing set of goods and services we consume with less labour. That represents an increase to us in our real incomes. And what's happened with new technologies up until now is that people find ways that they want to spend that extra real income. They buy more of the existing products, they buy new products. Often those new products have also been created by the new technologies. And of course, then that creates an offsetting increase in the demand for labour. It's also the case that while new technologies reduce demand for some types of labour, they're complementary to other types of labour. So with computers and IT, the general perception is that what they do is they've increased the demand for workers with cognitive, what are often sort of the ability to do cognitive, non-routine type tasks. The other aspect that's really important is that, of course, we as humans have adapted or changed as technologies change. So one thing that's happened in the Australian labour market since the early 1980s is a huge increase in the proportion of people with university degrees. So that proportion of people with bachelor's degrees has gone from about 5% in the early 1980s to 30%. What that means is that we have a much larger proportion of the workforce today who are able to work productively with the new technologies.
Because of the changes that especially ICT has brought, it's not the same everywhere, is it? It creates winners and losers. It affects different parts of Australia, different regions, but also different sectors in terms of and different educational levels. So it's not the same everywhere. For some people, it's a boon. For some, it's terrible.
That's right. And that's always been the story of technological change. Technological change creates losers and creates winners. Workers for whom the demand for labour is decreased by new technologies lose directly from the new technologies, but other workers where the new technology increases demand for the skills they have gain. That's really been the story of new technologies for as long as new technologies have been being created. If you go back to the Industrial Revolution, for example, look at what happened to handloom weavers when you had the new technologies for cotton production. Basically, that occupation was wiped out and their wages were reduced by a quarter because of the new technology. So, new technology clearly has distributional consequences. And so it's obviously important for economic policy to facilitate new technologies being used, because it's going to make us more productive and make us better off. But it's also really important for policy to address the distributional consequences of new technology, to try to make sure that people who are displaced because of new technologies have opportunities to regain employment, retrain, and so on. That's not something I think have generally done well in Australia in the past. It's also really important to have a strong social safety net for people who are losing out because of changes in technology.
Jeff, what about the pace of change? You have already mentioned it, but I mean, you can easily read, I've read many times, that my phone has more computing power than NASA took to send men to the moon. That's an astonishing change, and it must be almost unprecedented in history.
Well, it may be unprecedented in terms of computing capacity or measures like that, but I guess that's just one aspect of the economy. If you think back to times, for example, the introduction of electricity, mass electrification of homes and businesses, the impact on the ability of businesses to apply power in production is comparable back in the sort of 1920s, 1930s, and so on, is comparable to what we're observing sort of with communication and computing today. Light is another, if you go back hundreds of years and think about what was required sort of to provide a particular amount of light compared to what's required to provide the same amount of light today, that's on a similar proportion to the sort of changes we observe in things like ability to store data. So I think sometimes we focus on those aspects in society and the economy where change is occurring most rapidly. And we sort of think of that then as describing the whole of our whole of our experience, but it's not. And there've been lots of times in the past when there've been technologies which also in particular parts of society and the economy have been as transformative.
So why is that such a, I suppose, a widely held view that more or less that we live in a special time, a unique time?
Well, I can't claim that I know the answer for sure. We speculate in the research that we've done that maybe there are sort of various biases we have as humans that predispose us to believe that change is happening more rapidly today than in the past. One of the ideas we suggest is this idea, a bias that to feel that we live in special times. So the idea that sort of
because it makes us special, doesn't it? I mean, that's part
of
it.
Well, yeah, an unawareness of history. Sort of, I guess it makes sense to kind of think that you appreciate change that you're experiencing. Sort of, you may be more sensitive to it than hearing about things that happened in the past. As you said, maybe it makes us feel more special as well to feel that we live in these times. The other thing we suggest is that bias is being fed in various ways. So I always joke that if I was to write a book, I don't think anyone would want it because it would have the title of things are just the same. Whereas if you have a book that, you know, robots are taking our jobs, you know, the death of work, then you're more likely to catch attention and sell books. I think, you know, if you're a politician, it's good to claim that you've got, you know, larger, more substantial problems to solve than have existed in the past. Perhaps consulting firms sort of have an incentive to claim that businesses are faced by pressures on a scale that they've never faced before, so that you really need to buy our services because we can help you solve your problems. So we speculate that maybe there's this bias and it's fed in various ways.
If we don't live in special times, by that definition, what are, I suppose, the key concerns or challenges facing the Australian workforce? If it's not about the robots are coming and AI is coming to take our jobs, what should we be concerned about?
Well, I think we should be concerned about AI and technology. We shouldn't be concerned that AI and technology are about to cause the death of work. We shouldn't be concerned that it's causing a pace of change in the labour market that's more rapid than the past. But we should be concerned, first of all, that we provide an environment where the new technologies can be used, because that's going to raise productivity and real income. But we also should be concerned because new technologies do cause winners and losers, and that the current big source of winners and losers is the introduction of IT computer-based technologies. So we should really be worrying about the workers who are seeing a reduction in demand for their skills because of these new technologies. So we should worry about them, but we should worry about them in the right way.
Jeff, it's been very interesting to have you on the show today. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks very much, Richard.
Jeff Borland's Professor of Economics at the University of Melbourne. This is Best Practice on RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Adie. The Shire of East Pilbara is big. It's 372,571 square kilometres. If it was a country, it would rank as 62nd largest in the world, sitting between Japan and Germany. Running it is a unique challenge, and since 1998, it's been met by Alan Cooper. Friday was his last day in the job, so just before he finished, we got in touch, and Alan reflected on his role, his community, and life in Outback Australia. Let's start with a quick sketch of the Shire.
Well, the Shire of East Pilbara is in the northwest of Western Australia. It covers an area of 372,000 square kilometres, which is the largest shire in the southern hemisphere. We have 3,500 kilometres of roads, of which about 150 kilometres are sealed. We have three towns being Newman, Nullagine and Marble Bar, and a coastal strip of 60 kilometres based around the Cape Crawdon area. The main town of Newman is in the bottom southwest corner. We go right across the Tropic of Capricorn to the Northern Territory border, then under Halls Creek, Broome, up to the coast, under Port Hedland, and neighbour is the Shire of Ashburton.
Wow. Now, I'm thinking that makes you actually a lot bigger than a lot of countries.
Certainly. If you put our Shire map over that of Europe, you take in Britain, most of Europe, right out to the Russian border, just about, I think. So, yes, in a normal circumstances, when we talk to people from overseas, they can't believe the distances, even going from here to Perth being 1,200 kilometres away.
I'll come back to the distances because I think it's obviously integral to the Shire. But what does your job entail?
Well, certainly these days is making sure that we provide services to all three towns and right out to the coast where we do have a nature reserve, and making sure the people have access to the services, or we can point them in the right direction to services, because some of the towns are quite small. Nullagine has a population of around 80, Marble Bar is just on 200, but, you know, they expect the same services or access to services as the people in a Newman, which has 5,500 people.
And when you say services, what are we talking about?
From a local government perspective, you know, the rubbish is collected on time, they have access to parks, The children have skate parks, there's green areas, there's playground equipment, and people just can come and ask the normal question that you would ask when you go to your local council. Why do I pay my rates? How can I get health services? How can I get building services? That just the normal day-to-day services that you would ask your local council, we get to, like, from our constituents, and we need to respond to them.
You actually have to do more than that, though, because as I understand it, you run things like sewerage, you run the airport.
We have three airports. The major one in Newman does get RPT services every day, but we also have a strip at Marble Bar and Nullagine, and we do have a mechanical treatment plant at Newman, which is, you know, quite unusual in the state of WA for a local government to run a mechanical sewage treatment plant. But our airport has over 320,000 passengers a year. The sewage treatment plant has to keep ticking over, or else, yes, the Shire could be in the proverbial.
You mentioned the roads. I mean, how much of a challenge is that, making sure that they're maintained and open with some of the extreme weather that you get?
Well, certainly a challenge in the extreme times. And as the head of the organisation, it baffles me and how we can overcome it. But in a weather condition, you can't change it. The rivers will always go in that direction, or a creek will pop up that you've never had one before. Covering those things are just hard. But we have a crew, a large construction crew, which are continually out on the roads. The maintenance graders, which we have three of, are continually out on the road, and then we engage contractors to do construction work in certain areas. And this year alone, we had over $2 million worth of flood damage. Sometimes it does take months to spend the money and to get certain areas.
Actually, it occurs to me that sometimes it's going to take ages for councillors to get to meetings, because they're not only in Newman, are they? I mean, they can't be.
We have certainly an interesting dynamic in trying to get councillors to meeting, and trying to explain that to, you know, our city counterparts is, in our budget we have every year a fee to charter a plane. And so we have to pick up councillors either from the north to get them down to Newman, or from Newman to travel to the north. And also there's a considerable distance if they drive down. So we have a diversity of travel arrangements to get councillors to meetings. That's a built-in cost, and, you know, that's how we do business up here.
You've been at the council since, I think, 94, and chief executive since 98. One of the things on your watch is that you've managed to get revenues for the council to go up fairly sharply. How did you manage that?
Well, certainly during the early days, we were based around $15 million, but, you know, we peaked at $90 million, and that was through the Royalties for Regions program. But now, around $60 million. And it's the diversity of, you know, the staff, the growth within the town. And, you know, most of our shire has some mining-type tenement over it. And even though it might be a minimum rate, it certainly increases the amount of income we have. So it's just the mixture of income. You couldn't say that we've gone up specifically in one area, but rates have over time increased, but that's just because we've grown so much.
Now, I have to ask, because there must be big challenges in running such a vast but thinly populated shire. What are they?
Again, it's just making sure that people, and that is our management, our operators, the people on the ground, do know what is expected of them, and that they do represent us at all times. Because whilst we have a small administration crew in Marble Bar, they are the face of the Shire. So no matter where people go or where people are based for employment, they need to know what is going on in the rest of the Shire. But also myself, our directors, deputy CEO and the managers are always contactable by anyone within the Shire. So it's amazing that we are well known, and I think that makes a difference. People know who they can talk to.
I would imagine, yeah, because although it's a vast area, because it's a relatively small community or several small communities, it makes you, I would imagine, more visible, and you probably feel more accountable than somebody who's, say, running, a shire or local government authority in a city like Sydney or Melbourne.
Me in particular, if I go to the shops on a Saturday morning, if I don't time it right, you know, the half an hour shopping turns into a 3-hour expedition at times. because you do get those questions. People know you. They will ask you. It's not a 9-to-5 job. It is a 24-hour job. Whether you're at a function or a barbecue, people here, if you work for the Shire, they expect you to know what's going on, even though it's not always possible. Because if we lose a federal government service or a state government service, in the country regions, people always fall back to the local government. They want to know where they can get that service again or how they can access the service. Sometimes you get some strange questions about what we can do to assist people.
What about demands on those services and facilities? I suppose I'm wondering if there is sometimes a tension between locals and the fly-in, fly-out workers.
There has been, and certainly when you listen to the people, locals are very passionate about their town, and that's one good thing about country regions. They're there because they want to be there, most of them, whereas the fly-in, fly-outs or drive-in, drive-out don't have a close affinity to it, and sometimes it shows in their, I suppose, attitude towards the town. And, you know, they don't really appreciate what is around them in the communities. They really fly in. Sometimes they're just locked in a camp for weeks at a time and fly out again. They don't even know or see the local community.
So as you look back on getting on for a quarter of a century in East Pilbara.
A long time, and it is.
What do you think's your greatest achievement?
Well, I think is maintaining growth over that period of time. Whilst population-wise, we've gone from back in 1994, about 5,000 people, 2,000 had dropped down to 3,000 people, then peaked at 10,000 people, and now back to 5.5. I think the ability to maintain services and to provide a service to the community during that time, and in particular I'm talking about Newman here, but at the same time making sure that the smaller communities of Newman and Marble Bar don't miss out and try and get lost in the whole absorption of a mining construction boom that's happening around Newman. I think being able to provide services throughout the whole Shire and being able to diversify at times when the population moves is one thing I've been able to deal with over that time.
You've also been able to revitalise the town centre in Newman and the airport at Newman. That's a big success.
Well, two big things there. Way back in 2003, council started talking about the revitalisation of Newman Townsite and the area in particular. But at that time, we only had about $100,000 a year. And when the Royalties for Regions program come into being in Western Australia, and we got a really big start of $20 million, it just boosted the whole town. And then you could get partnerships. Council had more money, private enterprise put in. It just changed the face of Newman. And during that growth time, we've seen not only the Newman Town Centre, but also the Newman, Greater Newman revitalisation. There's new buildings, new sports facilities, arts centre, and now a new shopping centre was just opened. It's been a significant change. And the airport has grown exponentially. Back in 1996, when we took that over, was based on 30,000 passengers a year and a Donga as a terminal. Who would have thought passenger numbers would have peaked, 20 years later, or close to 20 years later, of 475,000 passengers per annum. The terminal's grown multiple times. We've got paid car parking. We have staff residences out there, hire cars, we have emergency services and multiple hangars. It's just the growth over that time is unbelievable. But I think, and it's just going to continue. Whilst the people may go up and down, we see new businesses on a regular basis.
Alan, I know you're heading back to the coast in your retirement. Good luck with it.
Well, I won't say retirement. People have asked me that. I think I'll use some other R words. That is probably refocus, reassess, and just consider what the future has to hold.
Well, good luck with it. Thank you very much for joining me on Best Practice.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And wish you well and Merry Christmas and keep safe.
Alan Cooper, the former CEO of the Shire of East Pilbara, and we wish him well. That's the show for this week. Thanks to producer Ian Coombe and sound engineer Tim Jenkins. I'm Richard Adie.